Near the end of his life, William Shakespeare moved from what could be called his tragedy period to his romance period. While plays such as King Lear, Hamlet, and Macbeth end on stages strewn with dead bodies, the romances, including The Tempest, end with the realization of hope beyond all hope. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, Director of Distance Learning at Wyoming Catholic College, and your host for these After Dinner Scholar podcasts. In November 1611, Shakespeare's The Tempest was first performed. It was in the age when human power, and European power in particular, was growing exponentially. The New World of the Americas was being explored and colonized, putting Europeans in contact with and conflict with hitherto unknown native peoples and building great wealth. Scientific discovery brought new powers over nature, and thinkers started calling human nature into question. In such a world, Shakespeare imagined a great magician with immense power over the wind, the sea, and the lives of people, including his enemies. The Tempest, says Wyoming Catholic College President Glenn Arbery, is the story of how that magician, Prospero, uses rather than abuses his power. Dr. Arbery is my guest on this week's After Dinner Scholar. Dr. Arbery, tell us a bit about the changes going on in the world that form the background to The Tempest.
Shakespeare wrote this play in 1611, and there were many major shifts in understanding happening at the time. Some of them were a little older, like the Copernican theories. Then Johannes Kepler, Galileo was alive in 1611. So there were things happening in the way the cosmos was imagined. Also, many political changes were underway. I think the main thrust of those has to do with the shift in kingship and the move toward a more popular power that you see reflected in Shakespeare's plays. And the main antagonist is usually some figure in the play or in the world who is more Machiavellian, putting more emphasis on power rather than some sort of ideal order of good that had been more traditional. So those things are just in the backdrop. Obviously, also the explorations of the New World were by this time over a century old, and the way that those discoveries led to reordering ideas of society and politics were pretty major. Thomas More, later St. Thomas More, had already taken in many of these, and Utopia, which was written, 1530s. So it had been in the air, and I think Shakespeare picks it up particularly in The Tempest, which is his last play.
The play begins with a tempest at sea, a tempest conjured up by Prospero, the magician who's the center of all this. How did Prospero develop these amazing powers?
Prospero was exiled from Milan, where he had been duke, because he spent too much time studying. I always find that funny. He wasn't practical enough being duke. He put his brother in charge of the actual duties of power. And Prospero resorted to his study, where he learned all sorts of things, not including how to keep from getting overthrown by your brother. When he was exiled, he and his daughter Miranda were put in a boat and sent out to sea, and an old Neapolitan counselor named Gonzalo managed to smuggle Prospero's books onto the boat. So Prospero's powers all come from this book, whatever this book is. It's some kind of lore, we assume. It's something that's been known before, that's been written, and Prospero accesses spiritual powers through this, and I'll have to explain what I mean by spiritual powers, but he accesses those through this book, and it gives him extraordinary influence over nature so that he can summon up storms, pretty much the way you would imagine Zeus doing, you know, the cloud gatherer back in the Iliad or the Odyssey. Prospero seems to possess powers over nature that come through his studies in magic, and magic is understood here not in a negative way, but in a very positive way. This kind of magic gives him mastery over all sorts of things.
Could you talk a little bit more about that idea of magic? Some listeners might be off-put by the idea of him being a magician, but it was a time when a magician and a scientist were sort of the same thing.
That's very well said. They were those who delved into the secrets of nature and the powers that could be unleashed the more you knew about natural phenomena. Obviously, this is the basis of the modern technological world, our use of natural forces, say electricity, to do all kinds of things that would have been unimaginable in the Middle Ages. Pico della Mirandola was an Italian humanist who wrote a famous work called The Oration on the Dignity of Man, and in it he distinguishes between the two kinds of magic, one being the dark arts, black magic. You sort of get this in the Harry Potter series now that I think about it. You know, those who are dark, like what's his name? The one whose name
Voldemort.
Shall not, yeah, the one whose name shall not be spoken. That's the dark art. And then the other kind of magic is more in line with science, with technology, and with a power to do good that seems to characterize a magician or magus like Prospero.
Prospero has, in a sense, as much power as you can imagine. He can control the wind and the waves, even. Now his brother Antonio, who usurped his position as the Duke of Milan, presumably thought he killed Prospero and Miranda in the process, is now at his mercy. And we could even argue that Prospero would have been just in dealing with Antonio in a pretty severe way, even killing him. But he doesn't. He uses his power in a very different way. Tell us about that. Where is Shakespeare taking us with all that?
I think Shakespeare imagines the kind of power that Prospero has as an analogy to his own art as a playwright. In other words, Prospero sets up situations that are themselves fictional, though they feel real, in order to bring about real moral results in the people who are subject to that art. When you go to a play, you undergo an imaginative experience. You know it's not real, and on the other hand, what you undergo is, in a sense, real. So I think that's what Shakespeare is pointing out with Prospero, that he brings about these effects in certain characters. For example, Alonso, who's king of Naples, actually does undergo in the play a moral change. He sees what was iniquitous about overthrowing Prospero. It's never clear in the play that Antonio, who undergoes the same kinds of experiences as Alonso, has any moral turn. And yet Prospero forgives him anyway. It's as though once his power has been stripped from him, once he's been neutralized in terms of his effect on people, Antonio can be let go without any harm coming from it. The real emphasis of the play toward the end is on forgiveness, so that it's not a revenge comedy, if you could put it that way. It feels like it sometimes, but it's a comedy in which someone is put in the position of being subject to revenge and then being forgiven for what he had done. There's a Shakespeare sonnet that, when we were doing this in the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, came up in the seminars. It begins, "They who have power to hurt and will do none," and so on. That seems to be the kind of character that we're looking at with Prospero.
Now, in addition to dealing with Antonio and his usurped position at Milan, Prospero arranges, we could say manipulates, love between his daughter Miranda and Ferdinand, the King of Naples' son. How does the question of power enter into that part of the play?
It's very interesting to get people's response to what happens in that scene when Prospero very carefully sets up the first impression that Ferdinand, who's the son of the King of Naples, has of Miranda, Prospero's daughter, or that Miranda has of Ferdinand. It's all arranged, and so what are we to say about this kind of matchmaking? Is it manipulating the affections of the young, or is it valid? You know, is it somehow okay? And I have to say, people split on this matter. Some people think it can't be true love if it's set up so well. And others say, well, no, that's just how what you do. That's how you arrange things. So Prospero is clearly drawing on the innate capacity to love and then just setting up the circumstances for his daughter. So it's another matter of art. Getting someone to fall in love with the right person would be a really nice thing to be able to do if you could bring it about. I know every parent thinks this, so Prospero is the one who seems to have the power to do it.
Well, and every playwright does it. Every novelist does it. Well, not every, but
that's right.
You know, it's the literary art.
It's the literary art, and if the playwright or novelist doesn't, in a sense, get you to fall in love with the character you're supposed to fall in love with, then the art hasn't worked. Then, of course, you take that by analogy and, you know, do whatever you will with it. But yeah, that's the art of poetry in many ways.
At the end of the play, Prospero casts his magic book into the sea, renounces all of his power, and asks the audience to release him from the island. Let your indulgence set me free. How does ceding power in the end crown the play and the message?
That's a great question, Jim. It's one of those questions you keep puzzling over as you think about this play, because Prospero has to, in a sense, put aside every control that he has over the circumstances of his own life. He is a fictional character, you could say. He's also Shakespeare in his role as playwright. And at the end of this play, he deliberately puts aside all the powers of his art and puts himself at the mercy of those who have experienced his art. Their applause is supposed to set the character free, whether this is Prospero or Shakespeare. There's a kind of approval that you hope for, but that you can't guarantee. You have no power over it, ultimately. So I think that's pointing, in a sense, to the plight of the artist. Ultimately, it's the approval of those who experience his art that he's after, and that will either validate him or not. And there's also a very strong feeling at the end of the play that this is the nature of grace as well. In other words, that we do everything we can, but then ultimately we're at the mercy of God and the grace that might come or not. And I think his whole plea here is for that mercy and grace.
Thank you very much.
You are very welcome. Thank you.
If you have not read The Tempest, let me urge you to do so. It's an entertaining story and one that speaks directly to our world, where power has run roughshod over reason and the good. If you wish to hear Dr. Arbery's lecture from the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought in its entirety, it's available for you as one of our podcasts. This concludes what has been a summer series of podcasts featuring the ideas and speakers at the 2017 Wyoming School of Catholic Thought. Let me encourage you to save the dates for the 2018 Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, June 10th to 14th, 2018, here in Lander, Wyoming. And our topic will be The Paradox of Courage, Desire to Live, Readiness to Die. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.